Welcome back to Unreasonable. We're here at the Summit for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C., hosted by Americans United, and we're sitting down for a long-anticipated chat with Congressman Jamie Raskin. Congressman Raskin has represented Maryland's 8th Congressional District since 2016, one of the scarce glimmers of hope that year, following both a career as a constitutional law professor at American University and having served in the Maryland State Senate, eventually rising to majority whip. In the U.S. House, and this is probably the part that you all know, Congressman Raskin served as chair of the Oversight Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, a member of the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus, helped draft the articles of impeachment of Donald Trump following the January 6th insurrection, became the lead impeachment manager in Trump's second Senate impeachment trial, a member of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol, and led the Democrats on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability. And trust me, everyone, I am paraphrasing. Congressman Raskin is here with us today at the summit because he's an icon of the secular movement, openly identifying as a humanist. Am I correct in saying so?
Well, I would hope everybody would be a humanist. Absolutely. So, yeah, like Bertrand Russell and Einstein and Spinoza. And yes.
And I would love for you to elaborate on that in just a minute. But I first have an obligation to lead our discussion with some information for you. And that is that my mom has a huge crush on you. I promised that I would relay that message.
Where is she voting?
She is in Chester County, Pennsylvania.
Very nice. Well, send her my love, all right?
I most certainly will. She'll be thrilled. So we were just talking off the record. We spent the morning presenting a workshop on grassroots organizing. It's been my vocation for years. Christina's an elections wonk, she calls herself, and you know she's much more than that. So we are especially eager to talk about Democracy Summer. This is the essence of how we save our country this year, in my opinion. So please tell us what it is and how it all got started.
Well, it got started because I was trying to get my kids and my nieces and nephews involved in my very first campaign for public office back in 2006. And I was trying to sign up my my high school and college age nieces and nephews. And they said, well, you know, what are we going to do? Put down on our resume that we worked for our uncle's losing state Senate campaign. And I said, first of all, we're not going to lose. We're going to win. And secondly, you're not just working on my campaign. You're part of Democracy Summer. Yeah. And they said, what's that? And I said, and then I had to make it up. And it was basically,
it's a thing now.
You know, we're going to get the greatest historians and political philosophers and campaign strategists and elected officials to come and talk about politics and about the civilizing movements that have transformed America. And it's basically grown to such a point that it's completely taken over my congressional campaign. I don't spend money on consultants and pollsters and TV and radio and all that stuff. It's all about education and organizing a new generation of leaders and activists. And we are now, I think, at 96 Democratic congressional campaigns that have signed up around the country. We're soon to go over 100, and we will have, I hope, as many as 1,500 or 2,000 young people working this summer as Democracy Summer Fellows, knocking on doors, canvassing, doing digital organizing, voter registration, and then improvising and creating methods to be as effective as possible to fight for a sweeping victory for democracy and freedom.
I want to put a fine point on what you just said, which is empowering young people to take their own initiative, which is something that I think is way too often ignored by this field.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of reject the traditional model of internship, which is you show up for a few hours and then you staple or Xerox or, you know, do something like that. I mean, if it's going to be a fair arrangement, we've got to invest in them. We've never had a single person turn us down as a speaker for Democracy Summer. And we used to begin by perhaps the greatest organizer in American history, Bob Moses from SNCC, coming and talking about Freedom Summer and Democracy Summer. And then we lost Bob, but John Lewis would come and do it. We've lost John, of course, but we have many other great organizers from our history who come and participate and talk about every kind of organizing, whether it's, you know, the women's movement, the labor movement, the peace movement, LGBTQ, and talk about what it means to organize and how that is a process where everybody's participating and everybody's contributing their best ideas and thoughts on how to move things forward.
So how can young people listening to this show engage with Democracy Summer? How do you get involved?
Well, go online and just Google Democracy Summer and my name or my campaign. And if you're in my district, we will channel you into my campaign. I think we have around 100 young people already who we've admitted and signed up. You got to fill out an application form. But then we've signed up hundreds and hundreds for around the country. And, you know, we might already have somebody in your congressional district. If you're not, you can join a neighboring congressional district. Or, you know, we've also tried to create projects that are organized around Democratic state or county parties. So,
you leveraging know, local resources.
Right. And I mean, what we're doing is everybody is together on the nationwide Zoom with our organizers and people who've come to speak. You know, Tim Snyder comes and talks about tyranny and democracy and the struggle in the world today about propaganda and disinformation. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi comes and talks about similar themes. And we have, you know, movement organizers, we have campaign organizers, we have election organizers. So it's not all about how everybody has to be involved in a political campaign. I mean, that should be a part of what everybody does. But there's other kinds of organizing that are absolutely central to our ability to move forward as a society.
It is invaluable that your experience is that of an organizer yourself, that you can relay these tactics that I think are so often ignored by folks who are maybe involved in this field and just climbing the ladder. Or, you know, I railed about that this morning when we were presenting. I want to pivot a little bit because I was very deliberately very vague in assessing your identity religiously. How would you describe your religious affiliation? We are here at the Summit for Religious Freedom.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Jewish, and my family is Reformed Jewish, and we belong to Temple Sinai. But in a philosophical sense, I resonate very strongly with the humanist tradition in America and around the world, and that's why I have no problem being identified as Jewish, which is my religion, and as humanist, which really is my philosophy.
Sure.
So I guess, you know, all of us wear a lot of different tags. I mean, I like to think of myself also as a pragmatist in the American philosophical sense of, you know, William James and John Dewey and the idea of trying things to make life better and seeing what works.
Sure. Well, you have that in common with at least two of us in the room, secular Jews. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm a music director at a Unitarian Universalist church, and I would call myself a devout UU with no God. So
I think it was Madison who said that one day everybody in America would be a Unitarian.
Interesting. I'm going to bring that back.
Oh, that's wild. So I wanted, if you're okay with it, I wanted to ask some questions about finances, particularly like Trump and MBS and Jared Kushner. And I'm wondering if there is any scrutiny on that entire situation, and if there will be any scrutiny. I know that there have been some talks, and I'm hoping that you could maybe elaborate on anything.
Yeah.
As we lead into an election year where we have not really touched on exactly how much. I know you're like the only person that talks about the enrichment that the Trump campaign really used the office for. And I'm hoping you can elaborate.
Well, there are a number of walls in the Constitution. And one, of course, is the Jeffersonian wall of separation between church and state. There's another wall between public office and public service and collection of money from foreign states and royals. And the Foreign Emoluments Clause says in Article 1, Section 9, that nobody in federal government shall accept a present, an emolument, which means a payment, an office, or a title of any kind whatever from a king, a prince, or a foreign state without the express permission of Congress to do so. And that wall was absolutely bulldozed during Donald Trump's administration. We have the documented receipts of nearly $8 million that he collected from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, China, which was actually the biggest financing state, but many others. And we only had information for the first 2 years of the Trump administration and for only 20 countries and for only four of Trump's more than 500 businesses. So the whole thing was a money-making operation from the beginning. So that's why I like to think there are two different public philosophies that are in contest in America right now. One says that the American government has got to be an instrument for the common good of everybody. And the other says, no, the government is an instrument for private self-enrichment of the guy who gets in. And then the domestic emoluments clause basically says the same thing, that you're limited to your salary in office and you can't take any other money from other federal departments. But again, Trump took money from the FBI and the Department of Commerce and the Secret Service, which was staying at the hotels and the golf courses and so on. And sometimes when I raise it, Donald Trump Jr. or another member of the family will get up and say, you know, my father didn't even accept his salary of $400,000 from the government.
My father.
Well, that's all you're allowed to accept.
Right.
All you can take is your federal salary. You can't take money from the Chinese government instead of your salary or the Saudi government. The whole design of the Constitution is that you go in as a loyal and faithful servant of the people, and you're not in a money-making situation where you can take money from everybody else if you give up your salary or you pay some of the, quote, profits from the foreign governments, which is the other thing they say. Well, we paid hundreds of thousands of dollars back to the U.S. government for profits we accepted from foreign governments. I'm sorry, but the Constitution doesn't say that you can't accept the profits. It says you can't take any money at all.
Well, so taking a step back, how difficult is enacting change right now? How difficult is it to enact legislation? And what are some of the processes by which we might think about mitigating these deficiencies in the legislative process?
Well, look, I mean, we have sharply divergent political parties at this point. I do believe that the Trump party now operates much more like an authoritarian religious cult than it operates like a real political party. So very little is getting done because they don't want to get anything done other than re-empower Donald Trump. So they don't have a legislative program. And of course, they want to defeat our legislative program, which is about the public interest. So I don't even know what it would mean to start passing bills that they believe in now. I mean, you know, reinstalling prayer in public schools or banning abortion nationwide, which a majority of the Republicans stand for. So when I call them a do-nothing Congress, that's at their best when they're doing nothing. If they're actually doing something, we're in real trouble. But having said that, I mean, I've always been somebody who believes very strongly in bipartisan and cross-partisan political work in legislatures.
You're a pragmatist.
When I was a state senator in Annapolis, you know, I introduced more than 100 bills that got passed, and the vast majority of them had Republican support, too. And that includes marriage equality and abolition of the death penalty and restoration of voting rights for former prisoners. So we can get stuff done. We can make government work. The problem is when you get one political faction which sees political gain in wrecking everything.
That's the point.
And turning people off from politics and government.
When you were doing bipartisan deals, that was like prior to the Tea Party movement? Or was that right after?
I wasn't in Congress, and I was in the state Senate. But, in there, we had, Democratic Party majorities in the House and the Senate. And so we were in a position where we could say, we want to hear from the Republicans and we want to reach out and try to come up with the best ideas we can. I mean, it doesn't mean that there won't be some fundamental value differences over things like abortion rights. But even there, I see a lot of Republicans coming over now.
We talk all the time internally and actually have spoken to a number of our guests about this. We see, aside from the inherent optimism generated by watching the other side overplay their hand, and I think give us an opportunity. I also see a space being created, I believe, for secular identity. You know, I think that this almost the religious right going after Roe v. Wade, you know, like,
yeah,
and trans bullying and basically sensationalist bullshit, if I may say. I think this is our opportunity to rise up and say, we are an alternative. Maybe you're devoutly religious, and that's great. We are a coalition to the point you brought up during the panel discussion that you just came from. You don't have to be non-religious or non-theistic to be a part of this movement. Do you agree that we may have an opportunity, actually, because religious nationalism has gone so far?
Sure. I mean, we have a free thought caucus in Congress that's basically unified around basic constitutional values. The separation of church and state is as American as apple pie. So we just want people to say that everybody can enjoy and experience and exercise their religious freedom and liberty, but we don't have any particular religious group that will impose an orthodoxy, a dogma, and a bar of political correctness on everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is one of the greatest, if not the central breakthrough of the American Constitution, that we separated church and state. And we said, we're not going to have an established church, and we're going to allow everybody to form their own relationship to God. And we're not going to allow anybody to seize state power and then impose their religion on others. And nor are we going to interfere with people's own decisions to believe as they will, or not to believe, you know, at all. I mean, that's just up to individuals. It's such a basic point. And I think the vast majority of the people reject the program of Christian white nationalism and what we saw explode in Washington on January 6, 2021.
Well, since you brought it up, you knew we were going to go there. January 6th, particularly the findings of the Select Committee. What were the learnings? What can we take away from that? And more importantly, we're all anxious. How do we avert the next one?
Well, I mean, vigilance is going to be the price of liberty and democracy here. We're going to have to defend, even for those of us who want to see the Electoral College replaced by a national popular vote, if that doesn't happen before November, and I don't think it will, then we've got to defend the Electoral College against those who would use violence or fraud to overrun it, which is what happened in January of 2021. So we got to play both offense in terms of moving forward to a national popular vote and defense in terms of defending the rules of the system as they exist right now. Donald Trump is already trying to delegitimize and undermine the election result in 2024. He doesn't have a plan to get a majority of Americans behind him at all. He doesn't have a plan to win the election. He has a plan to cast doubt on the election and then to mobilize those tools of delegitimization and fraud and violence to try to replace the result. Joe Biden beat him by more than 7 million votes, 306 to 232 in the Electoral College in 2020. And we're adding 10 or 12 million new young voters to the rolls in 2024. I mean, so we could be looking at a landslide repudiation and defeat of Donald Trump. But we know he's a guy who doesn't take no for an answer. So that means we have to use all of the legal resources at our disposal to defend the election result and translate that for people.
I'm so intrigued by what you just said about how there's actually optimism about our prospects in beating him fairly. I think there's a lot of anxiety right now, mostly about, oh, we're not going to beat Donald Trump. And you're saying, keep your eye on the ball, which is, doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, we have
he could lose
both.
Terribly.
I mean, we obviously have to do both.
Right, and of course.
It's not going to happen automatically, but I've been to 18 states now. I'm traveling all over the U.S. campaigning for the Democratic ticket. And I just have no doubt where the energy is, where the momentum is, where the people are. It's true that the red states are getting redder as young people flee in the wake of the Dobbs decision and the crackdown on the rights of women. I hope they're moving to swing states rather than to, you know, Berkeley and Brooklyn. Right. And, you know, I tell the young people today what I tell the little kids in soccer, don't bunch. Not everybody needs to live in DuPont Circle or, you know, Brooklyn or what have you. I mean, think strategically about where you're going to live and then go there and get involved. Obviously, Pennsylvania, where you guys live, is so important. Arizona is critical. Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, these are all critical places. Now, when we do grow out of the Electoral College and we move to a national popular vote, then everybody can live wherever they want and their vote is going to be equally meaningful. But right now, you know, everybody has to major in the Electoral College and don't be an Electoral College dropout, you know.
I like it.
So my concern surrounding elections is that since 2020, the pandemic made it easier for people to vote. Since 2020, 14 states have actually clamped down on ballot access. And those states are critical to actually winning the election.
Correct.
So I don't see any path towards things happening at a federal level that would actually
remedy that.
Right. Is there anything that can be done within these states? I mean, I know that you, am I correct? You went to school with Chesbrough too?
Like, he was a law classmate of mine.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah.
I didn't know him.
Yeah. The Kraken team, they have a lot of, can I say fuckery? They have a lot of like just different plans for shenanigans up their sleeves. And we can cut fuckery.
The Electoral College, I mean, the Electoral College is so antiquated and Byzantine and intricate and obsolete that there are all of these 18th century nooks and crannies in there that can be exploited by a strategic bad faith actor like Donald Trump. And, you know, it's not enough to have the vote in the states. Then you got to go to the legislature, and the legislature's got to ratify. And then the governor's got to issue a certificate of ascertainment, send it into the archivist and to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. Then we've got to meet in joint session. And look, if we're dealing with relatively rational and serene times, all of those things can happen in some kind of pro forma way, like the changing of the guard. But if somebody wants to try to blow it all up, as Trump did, each one of these moments is an opportunity to try to thwart popular rule and to, you know, just get the vice president, for example, to step outside of his administrative and ministerial role and then declare his running mate to be the president of the United States.
So I don't feel that way with this current administration. I don't think that Vice President Harris would do that. But I do have concerns about Mike Johnson.
I'm really curious to know what your message is this year to apathetic voters, because this is what we're all freaking out about, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I haven't met any apathetic voters. I mean, I met some people who describe themselves as cynical and jaded.
Maybe the one converting them on the spot, you know?
Maybe that's right.
That's it.
I mean, there are clearly people who have been turned off and negative about the whole political system. But I try to remind them that that has been Vladimir Putin and Steve Bannon's game plan from the beginning.
I loved that. Yeah, I heard you say that.
And, They, if you read this amazing book by Christopher Wiley called Mind Blank, that's not its actual title, but you can figure out what it is. You know, what he says is that they first set out to find the people who they could get to support Trump. They ran Facebook ads seeking out people who exhibited three different psychological characteristics: psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and narcissism, if that sounds familiar to you. And they found something like 3.2 or 3.4% of the public. And then they tried to find those people, register them to vote, get them involved, and so on. And then pretty soon, you know, we end up with what happened in Charlottesville with the Unite the Right rally. But the other side of it was to find the voters who would never support Trump, but to turn them off to Hillary. And one of the ways they did that was they identified young African-American men as a demographic that was not going to support Trump, but maybe could be alienated from Hillary. And they just blasted them nonstop with ads about super predators and running that over and over again, which was something that Hillary had actually said. But they came up with a media strategy that blew it extremely way out of proportion. And then, you know, basically carpet bombed part of the population with that. And that is their strategy. They will use the social media like that. All of which is to say that we have to be very shrewd in how we use social media and every technology available to reach people. And then also to run it with some political ethics. I mean, they're turning themselves into a cult over there, where they're either going to program you and brainwash you, or they're going to manipulate you. And we've got to be much more like a school. We've got to educate people and have real dialogue and discussion. And so that's why I'm glad about what you guys are doing in PA. And I feel very happy to be involved in Democracy Summer.
Yeah, I was very excited to hear about your model for Democracy Summer, speaking of it as almost a school, an education mechanism. So we're coming up on our half hour. I just wanted to ask you one last question. Again, since we're at the Summit for Religious Freedom, what advice do you have for secular organizers? You know, what is our message, both to destigmatize the label that is secularism, to speak about church-state separation in a way that is palatable, that is perceptible?
I mean, I wasn't even aware there is a stigma to it. There certainly shouldn't be a stigma to it. And I, of course, anchor all of my conversation about it in our glorious Constitution and what the framers wanted to do. I mean, this was the big breakthrough, right? Up until then, you know, everything was run by kings, and the kings got their power from God. And how do we know that? Because the kings told us they got their power from God. And the framers flipped all of it upside down and said, no, the people who are considered the rabble and the peasants are actually in charge. We the people, and those of us who aspire and attain a public office, are nothing but the servants of the people. And the minute that somebody begins to act like they are a ruler, they are a king or a queen above the law, and engage in high crimes and misdemeanors against the people, that's the moment to evict, eject, reject, impeach, try, convict, start all over again. We don't need that. Here the people rule.